Good morning and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee of the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is Tuesday, April 25th, 2017. The time is 9:05. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Carrie, and the LIO operator, Kyle. Appreciate all the work you're going to be doing as we hear this important legislation this week. With me this morning is Senator Gardner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Meyer, good morning. Senator Stevens, good morning.
Good morning.
And Vice Chair Senator Hughes, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
I'm Senator Mia Costello, and want to just thank the members for being here. We have a whole slate of hearings this week on House Bill 115. And just before we have the sponsor introduce the bill, I wanted to mention that beginning this session, we in this committee invited economists before us to talk about the economy. We learned that for the first time since the 80s, Alaska is experiencing a recession, and that economists asked the legislature to help provide some certainty for moving forward. We also learned about the extensive job losses that we're experiencing in Alaska, and we used their presentation as a basis for the remainder of the year, and we asked of every bill, you know, what impact will this have on our state's economy. So we're going to be continuing in that vein, and today we are having the introduction of House Bill 115, the income tax bill, and we have here today Representative Seaton, welcome, and your aide, welcome, Ms. Hansen, here to provide the introductory of House Bill 115 to the Senate Committee, Labor and Commerce Committee. And we will then ask that you introduce the bill, walk us through a sectional, and then we'll be setting it aside because we'll have more hearings today on the bill. Public testimony will be tonight at 6 o'clock, and so I know we've all been sharing that on Facebook and Twitter and email, and so wanted to just mention that before we start with the bill this morning. And with that, welcome Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the committee and yourself scheduling the bill for an early hearing here. I am Paul Seaton. I'm the representative of District 31, the Lower Kenai Peninsula, and House Bill 115 creates a broad-based tax on residents and non-residents based on their adjusted gross income and directs that revenues to the public education fund. Money in the public education fund flows automatically to fund the base student allocation, that's the formula, and pupil transportation. Under the bill, everyone is eligible for a $4,000 per person exemption for themselves and any dependents. And under the Education Funding Act, the permanent fund dividend will not be taxed. So those are exclusions from taxation. Under the brackets of the Education Funding Act, each Alaskan pays the same percentage on the first $50,000. So whether you're in a $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 bracket is brackets, just like the federal income tax. So the amount of tax doesn't go up on that initial $50,000 or incrementally above that in brackets. Income from sub-S corporations and partnerships, which are pass-through entities, will be included on the returns of individuals, the partners and the owners, just as it is on the federal level and every other income tax in the states. This is on net income after all business expenses and deductions. So again, this is adjusted gross income, that's line 37, after you take off our rental expenses off, if you have rental properties, after expenses for a corporation or for small businesses, those kind of things. The planned implementation date for the school tax is January 1, 2019, and this would be with when withholding would start from wages, with the first return date due in April 2020. So why do we need this bill? A broad-based tax is the last piece of a complete fiscal plan so that we can have a stable and sustainable future. Uncertainty, as you stated, is bad for the economy. Business leaders put decisions on hold because of uncertainty, and it's also bad for our schools. Each year, as you know, they the budgets try to pass, and they never know how much funding there is. And so teachers get laid off by middle of May. We have to be getting terminations for tenured teachers, earlier than that for untenured teachers. By directing revenues from this act to the Public Education Fund, we are forward funding education and eliminating some of that uncertainty. Adding a new revenue source also means we are protecting our schools from uncertainty by diversifying our revenues to reduce volatility. We have already experienced the growth of and contractions that come from relying too heavily on one source of income, especially that can be quite volatile. By drawing from multiple sources, and we can smooth out the ups and downs experienced by any one of them. The Education Funding Act is important for a fair and balanced plan, and all fiscal plans before the legislature this session require some use of the earnings of the permanent fund and a reduction in the size of the permanent fund dividend, which is regressive and hurts the lowest income Alaskans most. The school tax in House Bill 115 is the best broad-based tax to balance the reduction in the dividend. The dividend reduction being very regressive, in other words, impacting lower income families more than high income families. The options such as sales tax are also regressive and hit the same group of Alaskans twice. For example, under a general sales tax that raises $500 million in revenues, Alaskans in the bottom 20% of income would feel a 2.2% impact on their overall income, while the top 15% would contribute only 0.9%, and the top 1% would be only 0.4% impact. Connecting Alaskans directly with state services through a broad-based tax will increase the awareness and participation in how state governors' revenues are used. I know you, as well as myself, are always fielding questions about, I want you to do this because you're spending my tax dollars. And when you ask which tax dollars of residents of the state, it's like, oh, we don't pay state taxes. And we're the only state in the United States that doesn't have a broad-based tax of some kind. A broad-based tax also directly connects the state with the economic growth. There is currently no incentive for the state to encourage economic or population growth. 1,000 new jobs means more students in our schools, more people driving on our roads, more common state services, but without a broad-based tax, the state receives no revenue to help pay for the services that are needed for those additional people. This is a disincentive for economic growth. If the state is connected to growth through a broad-based revenue source, the state will be incentivized to make choices that grow our economy. Perhaps most importantly, other plans without broad-based tax leave deficits of $500 million to be filled at some future time from new revenues, drastic budget cuts, or spending down our savings. Leaving this sort of uncertainty in place puts at risk the savings and services we'd be preserving for future generations. Question is, why adjusted gross income? First of all, 29 other states use this as their starting point, and no state uses the percentage of federal tax liability as their starting point. This may seem like the simplest option, and it did to me at first, but it is not used anymore for a number of reasons. Volatility. If state revenues were tied to the federal tax liability, and as we can see, the federal government may now be changing the federal taxes or tax rates, then we, without any input from the state, we wouldn't control that and we would be in a volatile situation. This is why Alaska in 1975, first of all, it established its income tax in 1949 as a territory, and in 1975, after there had been fluctuations in the U.S. Tax rates, they changed to adjusted gross. And so that's the way it was from 1975 through 1980 as well. Avoiding volatility is one of the reasons we are proposing a complete and diversified fiscal plan. exemptions and credits, the federal tax code includes many exemptions and credits that pick winners and losers. By avoiding many of the federal exemptions and deductions, we are starting with a clean slate, and Alaska can make those choices for itself. The tax will be simpler to apply and will have a broader base. Equity between income sources. By using adjusted gross income, all sources of income are treated equally. If we were using the tax liability, there are adjustments to long-term capital gains, so they are taxed at a lesser rate than ordinary income, and we avoid that having to go back and recapture some of that as we did earlier by using adjusted gross income. Administrative ease. By using adjusted gross income as a starting point, it is much simpler for residents or for non-residents to separate their Alaska source income before they calculate their taxes due. If you use the tax a person paid on their federal, that includes all sources of income. Whereas if adjusted gross, it's much easier to calculate what was sourced in Alaska, which is the only thing we can legally tax non-residents on, and their total income from other states as well. And it's Alaska specific. By going to adjusted gross income instead of federal tax liability, the Education Funding Act can have adjustments that are unique to Alaskans. And specifically, we're able to exempt the permanent fund dividend from taxation, even though it's taxed at the federal level. And we're also able to exempt Alaska municipal bonds, which will encourage Alaskans and others to invest in their state infrastructure projects. Most importantly, the Alaska legislature cannot delegate its taxing authority to the administration to pick and choose and define what is and isn't taxable. It is our responsibility as the legislature to clearly define what is and what is not taxed. And so you will see the length of the bill before you is mostly technical details telling the administration exactly how to create regulations, because we are telling them what is taxed and what isn't, and so that we aren't out on that limb of having the regulations actually imposing taxes. So the legislature does that itself. Going over a little bit of the history of tax in Alaska, in 1949, the legislature put in place two taxes, and one of those was the school tax, which was just a per-head tax, $10, that was paid, and also the income tax. The territory was in deficit and was depending heavily on one industry to pay over 55% of the taxes in the state. At that time, it was fishing. However, we're in the same situation now where it's one industry is paying over half of the taxes, and that's, of course, oil. The territory was at the cusp of statehood, and some people argued that we were not ready for statehood. One outspoken critic, which was Judge Arnold at the time, a representative of the fishing industry, stated that, and I just quote, "Whether the people of Alaska are able to support statehood, they are certainly not willing to support it. So as long as Alaskans were content to let a single industry cover the bills, any calls for statehood should be ignored." And that is the situation we find, where are we willing to pay for some of the services we get, or do we only go to say that others should pay? In response, the people of the territory elected a new legislature, which met an emergency session and 11 days passed the income tax. Alaskans contributed to state services through both an income and school tax until 1980, when the huge oil boom led to the repeal of both. When the tax was originally implemented, it was based on federal tax liability, but changes in the 60s at the federal level meant there was a drastic drop in state revenues, requiring the system change. So by 1975, the state had its own tax brackets, which ranged from 3% to 14.5%. And we certainly, and we've recently come across a copy of the state income tax form from 1978, and we'd be happy to provide a copy for that if the committee would desire it. Similar to a proposal for the school tax in House Bill 115, the 1978 tax started with federal adjusted gross income and included some additions and subtractions and applied tax brackets, all on a one-page form. So what will the Education Act raise? According to the Department of Revenue estimates, the Education Funding Act will raise an estimated $678 million in the first full year. The first fiscal year, the state would collect half of the revenue because, of course, income tax is based on a calendar year. And so our fiscal year is starting in July and goes through June. So the first year of implementation, you would only collect half a year's worth of tax. So the second fiscal year, which is, would be FY20, the state would collect the first full year's of income tax. On this collected revenue, approximately $80 million would be collected from non-residents who work in the state. And the Department of Revenue estimates that the administration of the tax will cost between 1 and 1.5% of the total revenues raised. So it's a very efficient tax. The Education Funding Act is intended as part of a larger fiscal plan, including the restructuring of the permanent fund earnings and a change to the permanent fund dividend. Individuals and families in the lowest 20% of the income range will feel a reduction in the dividend the most, and it makes up a higher percentage of their income. Those in the higher income will contribute slightly higher percentage through the school tax, but we'll see smaller impact from the change to the dividend. Now, the higher income brackets will also see a larger offset in their federal tax liability, and if you're on the chart, you see that gray crosshatch area above. That's because more of those people itemize and their state income tax is deductible from their on their federal income tax forms if they itemize. The lowest 20% will feel approximately the same impact to their total income as the top 1% of filers when the Education Funding Act is combined with the impacts of the House Committee substitute for SB 26. This is based on the difference between the projected dividend in 2023 under the status quo and the projected dividend under the House version of House Senate Bill 26. However, the lowest income groups will feel a greater effect in the first couple of years because the dividend change will go in place first and the full income tax won't be in until 2020. Looking at the impact of just the Education Funding Act, that's the blue bars there. The lowest 20% will feel a 0.2% impact compared to their total income, and the top 1% will see a 2.7% impact compared to their total income. Looking at just the cut in the dividend, the red bars, the lowest income earners will feel a much larger effect than the top 1%, which will barely notice it, but you see across the range of income, and these are on quintiles, the fifths of income distribution in the state, it's very even. And the question is, how does Alaska compare to other states? And as you can see from the chart here, Alaska is currently the only state without some form of broad-based tax to support core state services. All other states have a statewide income tax, sales tax, property tax, or a combination of two or three of these. Even with local taxes that Alaskans pay, Alaskans still have the lowest state and local tax burden of all states, and we are currently ranked number 50 in the state and local tax burden. However, in terms of per capita income, Alaska is ranked 10th, meaning we have higher than average per capita income. The question is, how will the Education Funding Act compare to other states? 41 other states have statewide income tax, and two additional states have income tax only on interest and dividends. The school tax in House Bill 115 would be the fourth lowest when we look at the amount of tax revenue collected as a portion of total personal income in the state. The per capita revenue collected through this tax would also be near the bottom. Alaska would be number 30. The three states with lower tax rates have statewide sales taxes. North Dakota has a statewide sales tax of 5% and a total state and local rate of 6.78%. Arizona has a state sales tax of 5.6%, but the total state and local tax adds up to 8.25%. And Louisiana has a state sales tax of 5% and a total state and local share of 9.98%, the highest sales tax burden in the country. So as you can see, we are the fourth lowest, but if you're talking about broad-based taxes, all of those that are lower are much higher than we are because they all have a 6 to 10% state and local income tax. Alaska's average local sales tax is 1.76%. Of the six other states with no income tax, all have a statewide sales tax. As previously noted, the sales tax will be regressive and would impact local municipal revenue collections and would disproportionately affect more expensive communities. That's areas that have a higher cost structure. How do these tax brackets compare to other states? It's really difficult to accurately compare income taxes between states because there's so much differences in deductions, brackets, and credits. Some also have additional income taxes at the local levels. Some have separate tax brackets for general for joint filers, while others don't. Only some states adjust their brackets for inflation. With that said, here are some examples of states' brackets. Hawaii does not adjust their tax brackets for inflation. Hawaii uses adjusted gross income as a starting point. The top marginal bracket is 8.25 and it applies to all income over $48,000 and $96,000 for a joint filer. So far less than half of where we start with our top bracket. Compare this with Alaska, where the marginal rate would be 7% and it only applies above $250,000 for single filers or $500,000 for joint filers. Montana, as you can see, has tax rates similar to those proposed for Alaska. However, the top marginal rate at 6.9 comes much sooner at $17,000. So $17,000 compared to Alaska's at $250,000. And there are no separate tax brackets for joint filers, and Montana does adjust the brackets for inflation, as does Alaska. Our tax is adjusting for inflation, so we don't get this bracket creep where people, just by inflation, all of a sudden you are in a higher and higher tax bracket. So we do in this bill adjust for inflation. Ohio does not have a separate rate for joint filers, but does adjust its brackets for inflation. Ohio is the most similar to the proposed brackets in House Bill 115. In terms of the bracket cutoffs for the top rates, the top marginal rate for Ohio is 4.9%. However, Ohio also has income taxes at the local level, which average 2.5%. which would bring their estimated top marginal rate closer to 7.5%. The personal exemption in Ohio is half what is proposed under the Education Funding Act here. And similarly, Kentucky has an additional income tax at the local level of 2%, and the top rate applies to all income over $75,000. Remember, ours applies over $250,000. And Kentucky does not adjust its brackets for inflation or have a separate tax bracket. They do have a personal exemption, but it's only $10 per person instead of our $4,000. You will hear people saying that the proposed brackets that we have in the Education Funding Act are the 12th highest marginal tax rate in the country. You know, although this is an accurate slice, it gives a misimpression because just like you see on this tax here, it doesn't include the local income taxes that are allowed in these other states. So for both Kentucky and Ohio, they have local income taxes that apply on top of that. So their statewide marginal tax rates are much higher. The states that with top marginal brackets under 7%, only three of them kick it in an income level near the proposed bracket of $250,000 for Alaska. And the majority of states have the top marginal rate kick in after just the first $10,000 to $50,000. This means that they may have a lower marginal rate, but more people are paying the highest tax on the majority of their income, leading to a higher effective tax rate. This, combined with various deductions, makes it difficult to quickly compare which states truly have a higher marginal tax rate. And there's some more information on how different states create their brackets. 29 other states use federal adjusted gross, 14 automatically adjust their brackets for inflation, and 10 states double their brackets for joint filers, and 9 increase joint filing but not doubling it. 9 states have a flat tax that applies to all taxable income between 3% and 5.5%. Most but all states start their tax brackets at zero, with 30 states having a standard deduction of various amounts. The proposed school tax in HB 115 does not include a standard deduction, only a personal exemption. But we exclude the first $10,300, which is exempt, which serves the same purpose as a standard deduction. 4 states have a tax benefit recapture, which results in certain high-income taxpayers paying the top marginal rate on all their income, not just the amount above the bracket threshold, and we have no such proposal in House Bill 115. How are non-residents treated? According to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, in 2015, non-residents made up 21.3% of the total workforce and 16% of the total wages in the state. That is $2.7 billion in wages that left the state in 2015 without anything remaining here. That does not include income from self-employed individuals and certain other non-wage industries such as commercial fishing. The Department of Revenue estimates that non-residents will pay approximately $80 million of the $687 million in revenue that is collected. And as you've talked about getting some view of what the impact is across the state, this slide from Northern Economics that was presented to House Finance shows the projected job losses under a variety of budget scenarios. And the state already has lost jobs, and any choice we make to address the deficit will contribute to some future job loss before state employment is forecast to recover. It is just a matter of how much. According to the analysis from Northern Economics, a cut to the dividend or implementation of a broad-based tax would both have similar effects on employment forecasts as a whole. However, cutting the budget by an additional billion will by far have a greater effect with the full projected even with the full projected dividend. Cutting the budget instead of using the dividend or broad-based tax to fill a deficit would result in an estimated additional $10,000 jobs lost before employment is set to stabilize. Looking at the economic impacts of fiscal choices, any choice to fill a deficit will result in some job losses and overall income. It's just a matter of how much and from where. The only option which does not directly remove money from the economy is spending from our savings. But if we just spend from our savings now, it will mean that future Alaskans will be left with the same deficit and recession choices that we have before us. Most choices result in fairly similar impacts to direct income. But according to ICER, per $100 million in deficit reduction, taxes equals approximately 450 to 800 job loss, a dividend cut, 558 to 892 job loss, budget cuts, 988 80 to 1,260 jobs lost, and cuts to the state workforce, 1,400 to 1,600 jobs lost. And about 60% of those jobs would be lost in the private sector. So the ISO report indicates that for every two state employees that would lose their job due to budget cuts, three private sector jobs would be lost. Most revenue options would have fairly similar effects on job losses and income losses. So here's a federal tax form, and under the Education Funding Act, filers would start their adjusted gross income as reported on line 37, right down there at the bottom. Most residents would not have any adjustments except for deducting their permanent fund dividend. And you can see that little box up there where you check the number of dependents and you multiply that times 4,000 to get your exemptions. So if there are any adjustments necessary for taxable income or non-taxable federal municipal bonds, those are reported on lines 8A and 8B of 1040, which is above the adjusted gross. And the filer would simply add the or subtract the necessary number as reported. So in closing, I'd just like to say that it's important that we act on a complete fiscal plan this year, leaving a gap in the state budget to be either filled by yet unidentified revenues or budget cuts creates uncertainty. Business leaders have reported that they are waiting to make investment decisions in the state because of the uncertainty, and they do not know if next year they will be targeted for specific tax increases or if the state services their businesses rely on would be cut. They can move forward if they know the terms and can reasonably predict what next year's would be like. Uncertainty could lead to further reducing credit ratings, our bond credit ratings, and Alaska has incredible resources to draw from, more than most states, but until we show that we have a balanced and sustainable budget, the credit rating agencies may continue to downgrade our standing. In an ideal world, we would build each piece slowly, and under the Education Funding Act, the intended implementation date is January 1, 2019, which gives other parts of the fiscal plan time to be put in place. However, we can no longer afford to wait one more year to put one piece of the fiscal plan in action. If we do not act this year, our primary savings could be drained and our credit standing could be in jeopardy before we can bring the revenues online. We're relying too much on our savings now. We put risk, stability, and sustainability of fiscal plans for future Alaskans. And so thank you for allowing me to present this. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have or try to.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Before we do open it up for questions, I was hoping Ms. Hansen could walk us through the sectional that you provided for us.
For the record, Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. So as Representative Seaton noted, there are several pages, there are lots of portions of this bill that are technical and are meant to just clearly define income for the benefit of the of administering the tax. Section 1 of the bill just clarifies that there's a short title, that the act may be known as the Education Funding Act. Section 2 on page 1, line 10, is legislative intent language outlining what income levels for an individual or a couple would be considered exempt from the income tax. That's simply taking the amount of income that's taxed at zero and then adding the personal exemption that an individual or a couple would be eligible for. Section 3, which is page 2, line 8, clarifies that like any tax administered by the Department of Revenue, there is a penalty if a state return is not filed electronically. However, individual filers under the proposed tax are exempt from this penalty in a later section of the bill. Section 4, page 2, this is where we create the tax under AS 4322. And so starting on page 2, line 20, is where we create the brackets for the tax. This is 4322010. So this imposes a progressive tax on residents and non-residents on their taxable income, which will be defined later in the chapter. Taxable income is based on the federal adjusted gross income with some specific modifications. Residents are taxed on all taxable income, while non-resident individuals will be taxed on income from a source within the state. Later on, the committee will be hearing from Professor Pomp, who drafted some of the more technical sections. He drafted the sections as to make sure we were using strong language and clearly defining what income is and isn't taxable. But when we look at sections 43, 22, 010, 030, 045, places where we're making choices about the tax rates, about what it's being deducted and what's not, those were all choices made by our office.
Thank you. Just for members, we did hope to have Professor Pomp here at 5, and he's not able to make the meeting today, but thank you for that explanation.
So in subsection B of 43.22.010, this is where we see the outlines the income tax brackets for an individual filer. As Representative Seaton noted, all individual filers will pay the same tax rate on the first $50,000 of their income. Once they're over that $50,000, the next tax rate of 4% only applies to that income above $50,000. So that's where you'll see there's a total amount, and then it says plus 4% of the amount over. So that total amount is the lower tax rate for the first tax bracket, and then you just take the income minus above $50,000 and multiply that by 4. Subsection C outlines the income tax brackets for two individuals who file jointly. Those who are eligible to file a joint federal income tax return are eligible to file jointly with the state if they are residents. Under Section D and E, discusses what happens in the case of people who are eligible to file jointly with the federal government but chose either to file individually at the federal level or did not file at the federal level, in which case they would have the choice to file either as an individual or jointly at the state level. The tax brackets in subsection C, including the amount, the first amount that is not taxed, are simply double the tax brackets for the individual filers because there are two incomes counting on the same return. On the federal level, income tax brackets for the joint filers are directly doubled for the first couple brackets, and then after that, it's increased but not directly doubled. In subsection F, it addresses how to deal with two individuals who file a joint return but are not both residents. Because we can only tax non-residents on their income from a source within the state, having non-residents filed jointly would mean we'd be taxing, the non-state income from the non-resident spouse who doesn't work in the state would be a part of the tax calculation. It would make it complicated. It would also provide that non-resident with a benefit that residents who are paying their tax would not get. So for that reason, non-resident joint filers have a choice to either file jointly but consider themselves as a resident and be taxed on all of their income, or to file individually and then get the calculation which is applied to their Alaska source income only. 43.22.015 describes how you determine the tax due for a non-resident individual. They start by calculating their tax due as if they were a resident, so on all of their taxable income. They'll calculate their tax due, and then they'll multiply it by a fraction, which is their income from a source within the state divided by their total income. And so they'll reduce their tax due in proportion to the amount of their income that is from in the state. The reason we do it this way instead of just applying the brackets to their Alaska source income is that this method allows us to differentiate between someone who makes $10,000 in-state and $20,000 total versus somebody who makes $10,000 in-state and $90,000 total. As this is an income tax based partly on the ability to pay, and so this allows us to differentiate that. It's a it's an application of tax that has been used in other states and has been tested already at the Ninth Circuit Court. 4322020 defines the tax on trusts and estates. There are no states that have an individual income tax that don't tax trusts, but the tax on it, when a trust is taxed, it's taxed as an individual with its own tax brackets and everything. But most income from a trust simply flows back to the person who created it, which is called a grantor trust. So this tax on trusts only applies to a very small portion of trusts, those that keep the income within the trust and keep generating income in that trust instead of either paying it out to the beneficiary or being considered income of the person who created the trust. We are taxing trusts at the same brackets that an individual is taxed at, with one difference, which is that instead of getting the first $10,000 of income tax exempt, the trusts are taxed starting at $1. Since they're an entity and not an individual, they don't have living expenses. We determined it was more appropriate to tax them from $1. Additionally, the Alaska Native Settlement Trusts are taxed at 2.5%. This mirrors the federal treatment where they're taxed at the lowest marginal tax rate. These are trusts that were created under ANCSA. Section 4322025 describes a credit for income taxes paid in another state. Simply said, this ensures that a resident is not going to pay income tax on the same, pay two taxes on the same income. If they work in another state and are taxed on that income that they gain in that other state, our initial tax, because they're a resident, our initial calculation would include all of their income, but then they would be able to reduce the tax due to compensate for that income tax they already paid in another state. Section 4322030, which is page 7, this is one of those key sections that defines the income that is considered taxable by the state. Again, this begins with federal adjusted gross income and then has some specific modifications. The two modifications that are Alaska-specific are, as we mentioned previously, the dividend, which will not be taxed, and then the $4,000 per person exemption. Several of the other additions and subtractions here are actually ones that are required under federal law. For example, federally we cannot tax, under federal law we cannot tax most federal bonds, although they are taxed at the federal level. So any tax structure that would be put in place would need to take those federal bonds out of adjusted gross income before the tax could be calculated. We are also, the one other big thing that we're adding back in is municipal bonds. Most municipal bonds are not taxed at the federal level, but most states do tax municipal bonds. So we've added those back in, but we are exempting Alaska municipal bonds as a way to encourage investment in our state. And I would note that there was a slight typo in this section on the sectional as a result of an amendment that was put in place on the floor. I just didn't finish relettering the subsections. So subsection C is actually the one that deals with the personal exemption. It outlines that for a resident individual, the personal exemption is $4,000. For a non-resident individual, per person and dependent claimed on a federal tax form. For a non-resident individual, that exemption is $4,000 times that same factor that we used to figure out their tax due. So they get the same amount of benefit from the personal exemption as they're in proportion to the amount of income that they generate in the state, the percentage of their income that is generated in the state. And then subsection D relates to net operating losses, expenses. At the federal level, people and businesses are allowed to, if they incur a loss, they can carry that loss forward to future tax years. They can also carry that loss back to profitable years and basically get a refund from a tax return that was appropriately filed, but now they're saying I have a loss, I'm carrying it back. We are allowing, in this tax structure, we're allowing that net operating loss to be carried forward, but we're not allowing the operating loss to be carried back into profitable years. That's administratively pretty complicated and burdensome and costly to issue refunds because of a future adjustment to tax. 4322035, this is when we start, this is getting into those technical sections that are meant to clearly define for the department what income is taxable and how they should allocate income. This describes the incomes from partnerships or S corporations and how those should be adjusted for those, for the adjustments under 030, the addition or subtraction of federal bonds, addition or subtraction of municipal bonds. And it simply states that those changes to partnership or S corporation income should be made in the same manner that they would be at the federal level, and that the department, if they find that an allocation of income or adjustment of income is done for the purpose of evading tax, the department has the authority to make a ruling on that. Again, S corporations and partnerships are pass-through entities. They are not taxed under the corporate tax structure in Alaska because they are assumed to be passing through and be considered in on the individual's tax return. So we're not creating a new corporate tax structure. We are merely including that income in the individual's return as it is on the federal level, as it is under any tax structure. 4322040, which starts on page 11, describes how the income from a trust or estate shall be adjusted for, you know, additions and subtractions for municipal bonds, federal bonds, etc. And allows the Department of Revenue to determine in regulation how the adjustments to income will be allocated between the trust and between the beneficiary who is receiving the income from the trust. Section 4322045, page 11, line 15, defines taxable income for a non-resident. This is another key section for the department to have the authority to say what is and isn't taxed. Generally, this section has been structured to capture as much as we could think of as far as income that could be considered from a source within the state, so that to the extent possible, non-residents are being taxed on the same sorts of incomes that residents are. For most people, the item of importance will be A7, which covers wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services rendered in the state. Section 4322050, which starts on page 15, directs the Department of Revenue to create regulations determining what is considered income from a source in the state for business conducted by a non-resident individual, partnership, or S corporation, especially when a business is conducted partially in-state, partially out-of-state. This section is important because when you have a business that's acting both in-state and out-of-state, the allocation of income needs to be done according to the multi-state compact, which is already in our statutes. It's 4319. So this simply tells the department that when they're making those adjustments for taxable income, they will also do it in accordance with the multi-state compact for a business that's both in and out of state. 4322055, which is page 16, line 12, this directs the department to create regulations to detail what income from a non-resident trust or estate is considered derived from or connected with the source in the state, consistent with Section 045, which is where we define what is the taxable income for a non-resident. Section 4322060, page 16, line 30, provides what is a taxable income for a part-year resident trust or estate, and says that taxable income should be all of the taxable income associated with the part of the year where they were a resident, and then the taxable income from a source within the state for the part of the year where they're a non-resident. So somebody that moves partway through the year, they're partially a resident of our state, partially a resident of the state they move to. This just clearly defines how they will be taxed. Section 4322.065, page 17, line 12. This states that in case of a personal service corporation formed to evade taxes, the department can allocate that income between the personal service corporation and the employee owners if necessary to accurately reflect the source of income. With the exception of this having been redrafted by our legal drafters to fit into the Alaska statutes, this section closely mirrors federal tax code already, and states that do not have this type of language relating to personal service corporations have found some significant tax avoidance issues with these personal service corporations. Section 4322.070, page 18, line 9. This deals with a taxpayer's taxable year and the method of accounting, and basically states that the taxable year and the method for accounting will be the same as it is on the federal level. For most people, your taxable year is your calendar year, but for some S corporations or partnerships, they may instead use a fiscal year. So in those situations, this just says that they will use the same tax year that they use on the federal level. And also allows the department to set out regulations for how to address if a taxpayer were to change accounting methods year to year. Section 4322.075, which starts on page 18, line 18, establishes how taxpayers will submit their tax returns and how they will make payments for the individual income tax. Clarifies the tax is due and payable to the department at the same time and in the same manner as the tax is payable on the federal level, and also outlines the procedure in case there's changes to their tax return. And as noted in the beginning of the sectional, Section 075I exempts an individual from the penalty for not filing for their income tax electronically. However, somebody who's paid to file tax returns, so a tax preparer, is required to file their tax returns electronically. If you have questions on this, Mr. Spanos from Department of Revenue can expand on it, but basically by requiring a tax preparer to file electronically, this prevents some certain cases of fraud we've been seeing where the tax preparer might file one return with the department that has extra exemptions, etc., get a bigger refund, take that portion of the refund, and then give the tax return that is accurate to the person that they're filing on behalf of. So filing electronically, having the preparers file electronically just protects their clients against a potential fraud. Section 4322.080, which is page 19, establishes how taxes will be withheld by employers making payments of wages and salaries. They'll deduct the tax and withhold it and remit it to the department, and also provide a written statement, very similar to the W-2 that you already receive for your federal taxes. And the Department of Revenue will publish the rate of withholding required by this section. Should be able to use very similar structure, very similar forms as the employers are already doing on the federal level. In previous versions of this bill, we had considered having a withholding on independent contractors and people who file 1099 to assist with collections, especially we have so many non-resident fishermen that come up here and pay their crew shares on a 1099 but don't have very strong connections to the state otherwise. But after some research, it was determined that that this method of collection of withholding for independent contractors would be administratively complicated on their side and on our side, and so we chose not to pursue that option. On page 20, section 085, this outlines how partnerships that are required to file an annual information return with the federal government will also file with our Department of Revenue, and that they shall withhold income tax from a non-resident partner. Although we are exempting publicly traded partnerships from this requirement, it was noted by Tesoro that publicly traded partnerships, they're their partners can change fairly frequently throughout the year. So it would be unreasonable to expect them to withhold from their non-resident partners. In this section, we are also allowing partnerships to elect to file a composite return, which is basically where a non-resident says, the only income from the state that I have is from this partnership. I don't want to have to file an individual return with the state, so the return that you as the partnership are filing on my behalf is accurate. That's all the tax that's due. I'm not going to file a separate return. Section 43.22.090 simply allows the resident an option to apply all or some of their permanent fund dividend against their taxes due. This would be a voluntary option. It would be a checkbox on their dividend application, and would be treated just the way the Department of Revenue treats other prepayments or quarterly tax payments. Section 43.22.095 simply authorizes the department to create all the necessary forms and adopt the regulations needed to implement this act, including adopting by regulation any references to the Internal Revenue Code that are included throughout the bill. Subsection D directs the department to adjust the tax brackets and the personal exemption every 2 years based on the Anchorage rate of inflation. As Representative Seaton noted during the presentation, some states adjust their brackets for inflation, some states don't. We felt it was important to adjust for inflation so we didn't have that bracket creep where individuals, because their income is raised over time with inflation, suddenly find themselves in a different tax bracket. And then subsection E allows the legislature to deposit the estimated income collected from the tax into the public education fund. Section 43.22.100, which is page 22, allows the department to adopt the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code that I mentioned throughout the chapter as if they were directly defined in statute. It also allows, on request of the department, it allows them to adopt by reference certain IRS penalties for violation of the chapter, including, you know, fraud by tax preparers, etc. So allowing them to have some penalties to ensure people are following the law. For on page 23, section 43.22.110 simply allows tax information to be released to a banking institution if somebody's requested a direct deposit of a refund so that they can confirm that that refund has been deposited in the correct account and then the correct amount. Section 43.22.150, page 23, defines terms used throughout the chapter. This is another important section of the bill and one that we spent a lot of time working back and forth with the department to make sure it matched what is both legal and what is fits our desires for this tax. Specifically, a resident is defined as an individual who lives in the state for an entire calendar year, receives an Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, or receives a tax benefit, such as a property tax exemption that's only available to a resident individual. In this way, anybody who is claiming a dividend, which requires them to be a resident, is also going to be taxed as a resident. Another key term to be defined here is domiciled, but the difference between domiciled and resident, domiciled is a subjective term because you can say you have a house in two states. Having a house is an indicator that you're domiciled there, but it doesn't mean that you're domiciled there unless other factors are also true. So, another key term in here is how resident trusts are defined. The original technical draft that we received that Professor Pomp worked on had defined resident trusts fairly broadly. Basically, any trust that was administered in the state was considered a resident trust and would be taxed under this bill. That was not our intention. There had been discussion last year and this year about the importance of the trust industry in Alaska, both as creating an industry and also the amount of capital that's held in Alaska banks because of the trust industry. So But the trust is a complicated industry. It took us a little while to get this definition figured out. It happened in the committee process. But we've now basically, the resident trust is a trust that was created by somebody that was a resident at the time when they created the trust. And then those trusts that are administered in Alaska would only be, but have otherwise no other connection with the state, will only be taxed on their taxable income. So if they have income from an S corporation that is formed in the state, that would be taxed, but the rest of the income would not. Finally, Section 5, page 26, directs the department, the permanent fund division, to add to the application for the dividend to allow somebody to elect to use the dividend to prepay their tax. Section 6, page 27, repeals a former tax credit for political contributions that existed under our prior individual income tax and wasn't repealed when it was repealed in 1980. And then Section 7 clarifies that the state income tax created under this section only applies to income earned after the effective date of the income tax section. As was noted in the presentation, the planned implementation date is January 1st, 2019, which means the tax wouldn't be collected, would only apply to income earned after that date, but that's when the withholding would begin with the tax returns due in 2020. There is no effective date currently attached to the bill, but that was the planned implementation date. And then finally, Section 8 authorizes the Department of Revenue to adopt regulations to implement the Act. And I'm happy to answer more detailed questions on any of the sections of the bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hansen, for walking us through the sectional, and again, Representative Seaton for walking us through the bill. Are there questions of committee members? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question is, for Representative Seaton, can we get a copy of your opening comments?
Sure.
Thank you. That kind of helps me follow through.
And Representative Seaton, if you could just share those with my office, we can distribute that to all of the members.
Sure will. Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
And then two other questions, Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Gardner?
The first one is, in the very beginning, and you talked about the tax tables and the tax rate and said that the first $50,000 in income would all be taxed at the same rate. I'm assuming you mean adjusted gross income after the individual deductions and the PFD deductions and all of that are taken out.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, what I was trying to indicate was that these are brackets, and so the first, for an individual, basically the first $15,000 is untaxed, right, because you have $10,300 exemption, and then you have a $4,000 personal exemption, and then your PFD is not taxed as well. So when you add those up, you're $15,500. And for a couple, that would be double that, so $31,000. So the difference is that there's a 2.5% tax rate above your exempted amount up to $50,000. And so what I was meaning was that whatever you would pay below up to the $50,000, you're going to continue to pay that even if you make $75,000 or $100,000 or $200,000. Your first $50,000, everyone is taxed exactly the same in a bracket. And so that's what I was trying to indicate, not the specific tax. And it is, this seems like a complex bill. And although the bill may be technically complex to make sure that we exercise our authority in taxing and not trying to give that to any of that to regulations, which would be illegal for them to actually set a tax there, it's really pretty simple. The Senate majority and the House majority both have the tax calculator on the website, and what you do is you enter three things. You enter, are you filing jointly or singly, you know, how many exemptions do you have, and what's the amount of line 37, and you click the button, and it tells you exactly what your tax is. So it is a complex bill, but it's not a complex calculation to make because it's all off of adjusted gross income for almost everybody. Now, there's a few people that would have some other, if you had municipal bonds in the state and wanted to claim those as exempt, you would have to make an adjustment there. But, you know, 99.9% of the people in the state could use that little tax calculator, and in 1 minute, if they've done their federal tax form, they could go in and say, oh, how many exemptions do I have? Am I filing jointly or singly? And what was the amount on line 37? And hit submit, and the calculator calculates your tax for you. So although we have a 27-page bill, it's really to give the detailed instructions to the Department of Revenue so they can actually and legally implement regulations, because we've told them enough of who gets taxed on what.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on page 7 of your PowerPoint, the comparison of income loss, the permanent fund division dividend is reduced by $300 per person. On our comparison.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, what we're looking at is an estimated 2023. Estimate, you know, with a bad year coming in last year and all, that they estimate that the actual dividend in 2023 longer term would be $1,700. So the difference between that and the $1,250 is the reduction in the dividend.
Senator Gardner, through the chair, I believe you in your back.
Ms. Hansen.
I believe in your packet you have the full report from ITEP, which mm-hmm. shows next year where the change from the projected dividend to the dividend under 23 would be a greater change, but then over time, because as Representative Seaton mentioned, the earnings from the projected earnings that are paying out the status quo dividend are falling slightly, so that dividend is falling slightly, which leads to the projected dividends amounts in 2023.
Thank you. And one last question, Madam Chair, from
Senator
Mike.
Gardner.
Are there any states that require income tax on all earnings, even earnings from another state? So is there somebody, for example, my husband has a business partner in Massachusetts, and if that partner now pays Alaska state income tax, is it possible that in his home state he's also paying income tax on those same dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the compact, the interstate compact, allows a credit for taxes paid in one state against another. If you're a resident in Alaska with a if we have an income tax once it's in and you earn money in a state that does not have an income tax, then there wouldn't be anything to credit from that state against it. It's just like right now we have people from California that come up here, whether they're working on the slope or commercial fishing or in tourism industry, and they earn money in Alaska and they pay income tax, 13.5% income tax to California on that, and they have nothing to subtract from paying Alaskan tax on that same amount of income. So they don't double pay the income, but if you are working in a state that doesn't have an income tax, then the interstate compact gives you nothing to subtract from your state of residence. So that would only apply to those six states. If we implement an income tax here, that would only impact if you were earning income in one of the six states that doesn't have an income tax, because then you wouldn't have a tax to credit against what you paid here. But so you never pay double. It's the same with S corporations. Sometimes they make a payment on behalf of their owners, of their stockholders, but those are credited to the individual, so there's never double taxation. It's but there are some payments that are made by partnerships and sub-S corporations that can be made, you know, they don't have to be made, but can be made by those corporations on behalf of their shareholders, and those would be credited to the individual shareholders, so there's no double taxation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and thank you, Roger Seaton, for making it so simple and easy to understand. Couple of questions. I guess the first would be about the cost of managing and auditing and of the whole system. It looks like we're talking about 120 employees. Do we like figure out a percentage? We of what we collect, it costs us 20% to manage that. Have you figured that out?
Thank you. Yeah, I believe we have 60 employees, not 120. And there is there's an initial cost of $14 million, which is all the computer stuff and everything else. But they estimate 1 to 1.5% will be in total administrative costs. And one of the big helps with this is that it's all coming off of the IRS form. So what happens is we can rely pretty much on the Internal Revenue Service auditing for, and most people don't cheat on their federal taxes. I mean, the implications are pretty dire. And so using it off the, instead of a whole new tax, but having it come off of the adjusted gross income, then we can rely on the federal IRS for doing most of that auditing.
Thank you. And the, Madam Chair, the
Senator Stevens.
The fiscal note indicates that Montana has 155 employees, and when you look at Alaska, it should scale it back to 120, but we're planning on doing it with 60. Is that reasonable?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. I believe the Department of Revenue can speak to this in more detail this afternoon, but basically the 120 employees in Montana, that's their entire tax division, because their main tax is their income tax. We already have an existing tax division that's all of the front desk, administrative, the IT services, et cetera, that are administering more complicated taxes than this one. Namely the oil and gas tax being the biggest one. And so that's why the Department of Revenue estimated that we could scale back to approximately 60 staff, because the other half of that 120 already exist and already have their jobs established, and the extra burden on them wouldn't be so much.
Thank you. A final question, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Under Section 7, I just want to make sure I understand this. I think you are taxing retirement income, but it does say starts 2019 will not be applied to any income earned prior to that date. Retirement income, I think, is earned prior to that date. What is the intention of taxing retirement? I ask that for personal concerns.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, we'll be... The retirement Social Security pensions are taxed to the same extent that they're taxed on the federal level. Again, we're using adjusted gross income. So whatever is reported and taxable on the federal level is what we are taxing. So I know for Social Security, there's a calculation that's based on all your other types of income. You may not... Maybe none of your Social Security is taxable. Maybe up to 80% of it is taxable, again, depending on other income. We're not making any change to that. We're taking the exact amount that the federal government has decided is taxable and taxing that. Income that was originally put into a retirement or a pension was put in tax-free at that point, with the assumption that when you take it out, it would be taxed likely at a lower rate because your total income might be lower, so you'd be in a different tax bracket. So that was a policy decision.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Senator Stevens, line 16A is pensions and annuities, and then you can see the taxable amount is calculated therefore on 16B and is entered, as well as Social Security income is 20A, and then the taxable amount is calculated as 20B. So how those are handled on the federal level is exactly the same way, because it's all handled before adjusted gross income.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would agree with Senator Stevens that probably 60 people isn't going to be enough, but we'll address that with the administration. You made reference to the collection of the oil taxes, which is very complicated. But keep in mind, we're about 6-7 years behind on the audits for the oil industries. And I don't think we want to be that way on the income tax. But why does this have to be so complicated? Couldn't we just do a certain percent of whatever you pay to the feds, Representative Seaton?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that's the way we started out. We were looking at 15% of the federal tax liability, and when we had the public hearings, we had tax consultants, we had the public, we had a lot of people come and talk to us, and that's when we found the complications. And the problem with doing it on that federal tax liability also was, if an administration comes along and changes the federal tax rates, all of a sudden, you know, if they half the federal tax rates, all of a sudden we would get half. We could be a volatile source of income if we did it on the federal tax rate. So that was this year. That's one of the things that took so long. It was like, oh, this is going to be really complicated, and it's really going to be complicated when we have 20% of all the workers in Alaska being non-residents. How do you, when you're just doing a percentage of their of what they pay the feds, how do you separate the income that's sourced in Alaska, because we can't tax on a non-resident their income they earned in another state? And so those complications came through, and I think that that's why all states, that there used to be quite a few that did do exactly that as we did, and then in 1975 we gave up doing federal taxing a percentage of the federal tax rate. At that time it was 16% of the federal tax due, and every other state has seen those same complications and has given up that way, and almost all go to either the adjusted gross income as it is here, or to taxable income. But when you go to taxable income, then you are accepting all of the credits and all of the other determination. After adjusted gross income, there's a bunch of determinations that are made. Well, should we do child care credit? Should we do earned income tax credit? Should we, you know, all of those things. Once you get to taxable income, you're adopting a lot of those. And people were not sure they wanted to adopt all those federal categories of exemptions and deductions and credits. And so that's why most states have gone to working off adjusted gross income.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Madam Chair, if I may continue. Yeah, it's a shame we can't do something simple like just a certain percent. I mean, I think accountants are going to love your income tax bill, because we're going to have to hire more accountants. But it does seem like, when I compare your income tax bill with the governor's last year, his was a certain percent, and I think it was going to, estimated to generate about $400 million, and now over 1 year's time we're up to about $700 million. And I think that's the biggest fear my constituents have, is that once you start an income tax, it only goes up. Now, granted, 1980 we got rid of it, but we had so much money from the oil industry that I don't think anybody felt right about keeping an income tax. So that is a concern, and as you know, in the Senate, we don't believe we need $700 million with the PFD restructure, Senate Bill 26, at $2 billion, and the approximately $300 million in cuts. You're at 2.3, and your deficit's 2.7, so we're, under your proposal, under your income tax proposal, we'd be collecting approximately $300 million more than we need. And I think that's a concern of people, too. Are we going to now all of a sudden go back to our old habits of spending more money? whereas, again, in the Senate, we like that little bit of deficit, whether it's $300 million or $500 million. It keeps the pressure on us. It keeps spending down. And when you have $4 billion in your CBR, you can get away with that for quite some time and maybe hold off on an income tax, hold off on taking money from our constituents as long as possible, because it does have an impact to our constituents and to the economy. So I think that's why we're having difficulty with an income tax proposal. And frankly, it's very inefficient. I mean, we're going to give people, under your proposal, give people a dividend of $1,200 and then take it back via an income tax. I have so many constituents tell me that, look, if you need more money, just, reduce the dividend down to $800 because it has been that low in the past, rather than hiring another 60, 70, 80 more state employees collect the tax from working Alaskans. So I don't know if there's a question in there. It's more of a philosophical difference, I guess, we have in the need for an income tax. But certainly, Madam Chair, if you're okay, I'd like to hear the sponsors'
opinion. Representative Seaton.
Sure. And through the chair, Senator Meyer. I appreciate the question. First of all, a little correction. I think the governor's income tax was $200 million. Was what he was trying to target at and get. There was six. He was doing. He was trying to fill a particular hole in the budget that wasn't filled by the other taxes. There was like nine taxes that were all going in, and they were trying to fill the end. But you have to remember that instead of doing those nine individual targeted taxes, doing an income tax spreads that burden wider instead of targeting individual industries. But the big thing is that when we talk about efficiency, it costs exactly the same amount to administer a $650 million tax as it does a $200 million tax. So it's the same number of employees, the same number of everything, except the inefficiency, it's one-third as efficient. And this is a pretty, we say it's complicated, but when you can go to a little calculator that you have on your web page and put in three numbers, because you've already done your federal taxes or your tax consultant has, and you take the adjusted gross and put in whether you're filing jointly or singly and the number of dependents, and you click a button, and that tells you your tax. That's a pretty efficient and pretty simple way of doing that tax. So if you haven't gone to your website or our website and used that little calculator, I suggest everybody does that so they can see what their tax burden would be. And, when we did that with center representative, the 50,400, it turns out there for a single, if you were doing that as an individual, not as a married couple, it would be $847 or something like that. I forget the exact figure, but about $800 would be the tax that a single individual with $50,000 would pay. But you can just put those numbers in and calculate it and see exactly where it is. So the other thing is that many, many people use TurboTax or some other program like that, and all of those are set up with the state forms already in them. So what you would do is you'd do it, and it would automatically file your state form with you at the same time. The only difference is for people that do 1099s have contract employees, they would have to send a copy of that 1099 to the state. But it's W-2s or withholding, it'd be exactly the same. All those forms have a state withholding. There's generally an extra copy because it's for the state withholding that's right on those forms already. So as far as going out and individual businesses wouldn't have to do new computer programs or anything. If you do your own taxes, it's about a one-minute process to look at your line 37 adjusted gross and say, how many dependents do I have, and am I joint or filing jointly or separately, and hitting the button, and it tells you exactly how much your state tax would be. And so it's you know, in paper, it would be a one-page form that would go along just like we used to have between 1975 and 1980. It was one page, and it was sent in with the two pages of your 1040.
Madam Chairman, and
Senator Meyer.
I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details of this just yet, but it doesn't seem like it would be quite the same as your federal income tax. As you said, we're not taxing the PFD, but I do pay a tax at the federal level, so there would have to be some sort of adjustment made for that one in particular.
And through the chair, Representative Meyer, yeah, that little calculator that's on your website and ours gives you, when you take the number, because you're doing it as a resident, that takes off the PFD and takes off the $4,000. So at whatever the amount of the PFD was that year, it'll automatically do it. And so it's really not a hard program or difficult at all.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Seaton and the staff, for being here today and presenting. And this has awakened the sleeping giant in my district, I will tell you. I'm hearing from lots of folks on it. How many, I believe the population is about 740,000. So how many Alaskans would pay this tax? What's the estimated number?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, in tax year 2014, there were 361,130 tax returns, and half of those were joint returns. So 500,000 people filing, and our population of 700,000 includes children. So, and then some of those on the federal level, you know, and ended up with a zero tax liability. Again, part of that is because you get all the way down into the child tax credit and the earned income credit, which we are not giving. So I think although they would have a small tax liability, there's definitely a range of people that file on the federal level but end up getting their earned income credit and don't have a federal tax liability. Most of the filers that would be required to file under the state income tax would be paying a small portion.
Madam Chair?
Senator Hughes?
And of those filed jointly, I think some of those, there's not always a second income with some of those, or it's very small. I've heard a much smaller number, like 330,000. But considering that, you know, we've heard this reference as a broad-based tax, and to me, a broad-based would be to everyone. So I think that's a misnomer to some extent, especially if it is under 400,000. And I'm wondering, in your calculations as far as what this might bring, have you accounted for out-migration? Because I understand other states, when income taxes have been implemented, that people will move, and I've had literally hundreds of contacts, people specifically saying that they would leave the state, whether they would or not, that's would be yet to be seen. But I'm just wondering if your calculations account for out-migration, because that concerns me, because then the ratio of those who pay and those who don't pay, those who require public assistance and stuff, that ratio compared to workers would become skewed. So have you accounted for out-migration?
The calculation, through the chair, Senator Hughes, the calculations were done by the Department of Revenue on the fiscal note. And, you know, people could go to six other states, but otherwise they're going to go someplace that they're going to pay a higher tax burden, because we have the lowest tax burden, even with this tax, of any state in the nation. So if people want to move to pay more taxes, that's what they would do, because there's nowhere else in the United States that they can move that they would have a lower tax burden than even after we implement this tax they would have in Alaska. So I think, you know, people can make those decisions based on that. I mean, you don't see the most populous states in the nation They also have the highest, some of the highest income tax and sales tax rates, and those states haven't been abandoned for the ones that don't have taxes. And you see things like Washington doesn't have a income tax. However, you just saw Boeing abandon Washington for manufacturing in other places. So all of these decisions aren't based on the tax in, at least that's the conclusion you have to reach if you look at the tax rates and the population in the states and where would people go. So people might go to someplace else, but I don't know where it would be.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes.
And I don't think that that simply looking at tax rates is all there is. There's a lot of places where it's very less expensive to live than Alaska, and so that's factored into those decisions. And so a person is looking at their household budget and if they can live somewhere less expensive. That is my concern. And then the other thing, the final question, because I know we have floor here on the Senate side, is the impact on the S-corps, the small businesses, because that discretionary income that they have at the end of the year is what they cycle back in to grow their businesses, and that's what creates jobs. So have you looked specifically on the economic impact on small businesses related to HB 115? They're the backbone of our communities, and so I'm concerned about that.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we've looked where we can, and we've gotten ICER, we've gotten Northern Economic Studies, we've gotten the studies that say, you know, this is the lowest job loss kind of option you're going to have for closing a deficit. So have we looked everything? No, we've gotten as much information as we can. We've, you have the comparing the distributional impact of revenue options in Alaska just came out yesterday from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, and so you can make the comparison in there. You know, lots of people that are worried about their taxes, you know, a family, married couple filing jointly, $30,000, $31,000 is before they pay anything. And after that, they pay $25 per thousand above that $31,000 amount, up to $50,000. So it depends on what tax bracket they're in, depends on how much they make. A lot of people seem to have the idea that they're going to be paying, like some states, from dollar one. And here, there's, for a single individual, it's going to be $15,000, basically, or depending upon exactly what the PFD would be, but it'd be $15,000, or a married couple, or a couple filing jointly would be $31,000, would be totally tax exempt. So, I don't think people have gone to the little tax calculator that's on your and our website and put in their numbers and said, oh, well, I guess it's not nearly as big a hit as they thought it would be for most people. I mean, if people are in the million or multi-million dollar income level, then the tax burden is more. I mean, there's no question about that. That's the way an income tax is made, and the reduction in the PFD is much more impactful on the people on the very bottom scale or even on the mid-scale, the mid-20%. It's, the middle-income people are less impacted by the income tax than they are by sales tax or anything else. And I think that's really good information that just came out on looking at generating $500 million of deficit reduction and how you would do. So hopefully everybody will have a chance to look at that distributional impact, because if you're talking about middle income, the income tax has less impact on middle-income people and lower-income and the lowest 20 than any other form of reducing the deficit that we have.
Senator Hughes?
One quick thing. My concern is that most Alaskans fall in that middle income, so it is hitting a lot of people. But you've mentioned the calculator a couple of times, and I did play with it. And I'm wondering what your thinking was. Why are you taxing a single-parent household, let's say a single parent with two children that's making $75,000 more than a jointly filing couple making the same income at $75,000 with two children? The single parent is paying more. Why did you set it up that way?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, is set up on the individual basis. You can file separately if you want. You can file jointly if you want. There's no advantage for filing jointly. There's just another person there. There's another income earner. And so you have four people instead of three people. And so there's more exemptions. There's more PFDs. And so that's where you are. So if you have less dependents raising more money, then the bracket's going to be higher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just concerned about that single parent paying more. Thank you.
Thank you very much again, Representative Seaton and Ms. Hansen. For committee members, our next meeting is today at 1:30. We will have the Department of Revenue here for the purpose of explaining how the income tax bill would be implemented in our state. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.